So, in your notes, page 19, the authenticity of Christianity hinges upon a singular event. The single most important event is that of the resurrection. If it did not take place, then Christianity is insignificant. It is completely insignificant if the resurrection didn't place. I mean, it wouldn't even classify as a good moral kind of club to be a part of, because it's basically wrapped up in deception and encouraging others to join. I mean, it's in line with those cults that we look at and say, man, I can't believe they'd do that. If it's true that Christ did not resurrect. And so we have to take a moment and look at this and try to identify, is this something that's plausible to believe in? And it comes back to this idea of explanation. And what is the best explanation? So the first question is, why would such a claim even be considered a possibility? How could someone even claim that a resurrection took place?
They witnessed
the resurrection?
No, but they saw the empty tomb and then Jesus told them it.
Okay, so a witness of the empty tomb. All right, I'll combine both of those. Right? Yes. The witness of the empty tomb would be what could allow us to begin, right? For instance, if, let's say, you guys know who Ron Whitfield is? Okay. Let's say Ron Whitfield is out, you know, in his Bobcat or whatever, and he's playing around and he's doing his thing, this kid's having fun. And all of us are watching it, but we see a cliff, and we see him go off the edge in his Bobcat cliff. Although Ron's he's a very tough guy, very resilient, he doesn't survive. And so we all witness his death. Gruesome death, we see the paramedics come, they pull his body out of the cab, he's dead. And we all witness it. And then we all go to his funeral and we watch him be buried. And we come back here to this atrium and we have donuts and coffee and we remember the life of Ron Whitfield. Well, 3 days later, Pastor Doug gets up in the pulpit and says, hey, guess what? Ron's alive, he's risen. He's risen indeed, right? And we're all going, wait a minute, we saw this. We saw the death happen. We saw where he's buried. And so the first thing we want to do is go back to the gravesite to verify, because as much as we trust Pastor Doug, we're still going to go, okay, that defies reality. This is a little bit weird. This is something that's a little hard to comprehend. And we might go back to the grave and open it up, as weird as that might sound, and identify for ourselves, because if the body's still in there, then what the claims that have been made are completely false. And we know that. But if the body's gone, then we have a grounding in which we can start to comprehend and start to ask the questions and believe, okay, maybe he has risen. Now that becomes a possible explanation. So, first of all, since this is such an unusual claim, we want to ask the question, what would allow the people to originally accept the tomb as empty as a claim as well? Because not only is resurrection a pretty incredible claim, well, the tomb being empty, there's some things that we have to verify for us to believe that the tomb, in fact, was empty. And so here's a list of evidence that suggests the truth of this necessary fact that the tomb was, in fact, empty. Within 6 to 7 weeks, the resurrection was first proclaimed in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem. That's a key. This is resulting in the birth of a church within the city where the crucifixion and burial took place, which is inexplicable if the tomb was not actually empty. Why is it inexplicable?
Because it would have stopped as soon as somebody found it at all.
Okay, so people are proclaiming that Christ rose from the dead, that he is the Messiah. And then as soon as the tomb was found occupied, they would say, no, that's wrong. In fact, we had a special, I think it was about a year ago, it was called The Tomb of Jesus. It was on Discovery Channel and History Channel, and that one documentary guy came out and did this documentary about how they found an empty tomb, and it was under a sewer main in an apartment complex in Jerusalem. And they found this old tomb, and they found some other, I guess, sarcophaguses in these little stone boxes or whatever, and they thought they found Mary's and possibly Jesus' brother. And so there was this one inscription on there that was kind of loose to find, but it was a derivative of the name of Jesus, and so was the Mary, the mother of Jesus. It was a derivative. It was Mariamna or something like that. And so this guy concluded that Jesus, in fact, his remains are still in the tomb. And it was this big discussion afterwards, you know, what would happen if that was the case? What would happen if that was true? And it was great because they had some pretty solid Christian theologians and apologists in a roundtable discussion after this documentary occurred. And they really took him to task on his professional trade as an archaeologist, that he did a lot of stuff. Very recklessly, and the conclusions that were drawn were, and some of the figures were made up as far as probabilities and everything like that. So it was shown to be a sham, but it raises the question. If Jesus' remains were found, we have a serious issue on our hands. And so for these people, for it to be proclaimed in Jerusalem, the epicenter of the events that took place, there are people there, eyewitnesses, that could go, identify where the tomb is. They could identify it's occupied. And they could, you know, falsify, I guess, the claims that were being made. So people can check it. And also, if you were making it all up, wouldn't you go to, like, Greece or possibly Egypt or some other territory where they probably hadn't heard of Jesus yet? You'd go to a place, if you were finding a new religion, to a place where you probably have as little opposition as possible, if that was truly your intention. And so it doesn't seem likely that it being proclaimed within 6 to 7 weeks, so within 2 months, in the place where it took place. Okay?
Do you have any, not to get too far off, but a lot of people believe that, you know, the apostles went back and stole the body.
Mm-hmm. We're going to look at that. We're going to, I think, look at 9 possible explanations for why the tomb is empty.
Okay.
And we're going to look at kind of the explanatory power of each act. That's a great point. Okay, the second piece of evidence is those opposing the resurrection claim did not deny the tomb was empty. And the reason why we know that is because they give alternative explanations as to why it was empty. So those opposing Christianity didn't deny the fact that it was empty, but they gave other explanations for it being empty. And this is one of the strongest pieces of evidence you could have in a court case or anything like that. And it's called enemy attestation. Enemy attestation. Did someone say that's a cool word? It is a cool word. It's a fun word. You can say to your friends and sound really smart. Enemy attestation, it just simply is when those opposing or the opponents of a certain ideal or idea basically attest to it, and they agree that that's the case. So when your enemies and those opposed to you would have every reason to somehow come up with a reason to deny that fact, when they approve of it and agree that that's the case, then you know that you have a strong piece of evidence. It was occupied. If it was occupied, we might expect them to point out that his body is still in the tomb and exposed the sham, but all explanations assume his body was not there. Okay, so the key issue in the debate is why is it empty? Not whether it is, but why it was empty. Furthermore, it would seem irrational for the gospel writers themselves to accept the proclaim of the resurrection if the tomb was still occupied. Why would it be irrational for the gospel writers? We're not talking about necessarily all the apostles, but we're talking about those that wrote Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Why would it be irrational for them to record that?
It would invalidate everything else they had written.
Okay. True. Right. They're putting out things that they're proclaiming as historical narratives, is legitimate copies of what occurred. And as soon as they put this in, they're a whole lie. Remember when we were talking about the Gospel of Mark? It was written within 20 years of the events taking place. So there are plenty of people still alive as this is being circulated and traveling to churches and traveling to Jerusalem. So people then could read what supposedly took place and deny it. And if that's the case, well, then their thing is completely wrong. Because it's not like, I really do not like talking about Hillary Clinton as much as we do. But the fact that she wrote down her account in Bosnia really was the tough thing that nailed her. Okay, she wrote down a certain account of sniper or whatever happening. And then as she was saying it, that was coming back up. And people were able to sit down and reference it. Here's a hard copy of what you've said. Whereas if people are just proclaiming it by mouth, you know, people could say, well, that's not exactly what I said. And they could try to hem and haw their way out of it. But when it's written down, then it becomes even more, well, it's stuck to you. This is what you said. And so it's irrational for the gospel writers to put out a copy or produce a work that claims something that's completely false and can be proven by an entire city of people, for that matter. So yes, it would have been irrational. And if it was occupied, they couldn't have been confused by that fact. And then the fourth thing, due to the fact that no one actually witnessed Jesus leaving the tomb, no one could have identified the resurrection as taking place on the third day unless it was actually found empty on the third day after the crucifixion. That's a point that's often missed and not used often, but I mean, everyone identifies, you know, the third day, he's risen on the third day, and that's the proclamation. And since no one witnessed him walking out or leaving the tomb on the third day, the only way they could know that is if they discovered the tomb empty on the third day. That's the only way to validate that. Okay? So, these facts provide sufficient justification to believe that he has been buried in a tomb which was found empty. The next task is to identify what else took place surrounding the death of Jesus, specifically that which followed the crucifixion. So, this is kind of the fun part, because we get a We have a list of evidence and things that we know to be true about surrounding this event. And then we have, I think if you turn your page, you'll see a list of possible explanations, and there's 8 of them. Okay, and the reason why these are included is because these are probably the most popular in the sense of the most people subscribing to these various explanations and trying to defend them. So we're going to take these 8 explanations and match them up against what we know. So in a sense, we kind of get to be a jury now. Okay, and the subject under observation is, did Jesus rise from the dead? Why was the tomb empty? And so we're going to look through and have some witnesses, in a sense, come forward with these different explanations, and we're going to weigh them. How do they explain what we know about the situation? And so what we're looking for is the best explanatory power, or which explanation has the most explanatory power to explain what we know about the event. Okay? So here are the facts. The tomb was discovered empty within 3 days. The disciples had experiences which they believed were literal appearances of a risen Christ. Why would I include the word literal there?
Well, for a while they thought he was a ghost.
Okay.
So, because they witnessed his death, so he was saying, you know, check it out, I'm hungry, let's have some food so you can see it.
Okay, so he's showing signs of being a physical body.
Yeah.
There's scars, there's wounds, there's an appetite. There's also, as we talked a little bit about, there were heretics coming out within 20, 30 years that were saying different things about Jesus. They were saying things like, well, he didn't really come in the flesh. Or when he resurrected, it wasn't a physical resurrection, it was a spiritual resurrection. He was an apparition. And they saw a vision or a ghost type of thing. But we have to understand that the disciples had experiences which they believed were literal appearances. They didn't believe their experiences to be apparitions, ghost-like, mystical, spiritual things. They were physical. They thought they were experiencing a literal appearance of risen Christ. The third thing is the disciples who had experienced doubt and despair became bold proclaimers of the death and the resurrection of Jesus. So circle that one. That's probably the most significant piece of evidence we have as far as we know for sure that they were doubtful, they were despairing, they gave up hope, they were denying ever knowing him. They went back to their careers, their fishing boats. They were like, okay, that was a good run, 3 years. Too bad it didn't pan out. And they were in despair. They fled. In fact, the only apostle that was faithful that we know of was John, who was kind of there throughout the whole thing, comforting Jesus' mother. And so this idea that they were doubtful and despairing, and then they became bold proclaimers, something has to have happened there. Okay. The message of a resurrection was proclaimed in Jerusalem, resulting in the birth of the church. And the disciples suffered and ultimately died for their message. So, these are important pieces of information that we have. These are facts that we know surrounding this stuff. These are things that aren't disputed. Now, obviously, there's some stuff within these facts that are disputed, like, well, it's disputed whether it was a literal resurrection. But it's not disputed that the apostles thought themselves experiencing a physical resurrection. Does that make sense? It's not debated whether or not the disciples doubted. And then it's not debated that they were bold proclaimers. So these things are facts. These are things that are accepted in the realm of scholarship. So these are things that we can hang on to and say, okay, if these are widely accepted, then let's take all the explanations you can throw at us and let's see which can explain these things. And that's what we're going to do, okay?
Wouldn't you include verse 6 in these facts?
Verse 6.
You've got 500 people. Many of them are still alive. 25 years after the fact, they were eyewitnesses.
So the multiple appearances you could put in this fact, that can't be disputed simply because there's nothing outside of the Bible that corroborates that.
We don't have their testimony, it's hearsay, actually.
So what we have here are things that are less disputed than, I mean, I think that would be a widely accepted fact, but we don't even need to include that in order to accomplish what we want to accomplish. That makes sense. So since we haven't witnessed the events ourselves, the question is, what is the best explanation? The empty tomb seems to be the key factor, so we must consider the possible explanations. Okay, so this is the fun part. What we're going to do is go through each explanation, and you're going to help me identify why these possibly have some holes in them, and why these explanations maybe don't measure up, and they've been found wanting. Okay, they went to the wrong tomb. Okay, that's one of the explanations, that all of the apostles and disciples and the followers of Christ just happened to go to the wrong place. How would you respond, or why do you think that's kind of a weak explanation?
First of all, everybody knew, and if it was the opposite side that was trying to deny this, then they would have found the right tomb.
Okay, and it goes back to this enemy attestation. Those opposed to Christianity had enough vested to see it fail, to identify the right tomb. As they're making these claims, they could have gone out and found the right tomb. Now, whose tomb was it that he was buried in?
Joseph
of Arimathea, okay? And who was Joseph? What was he?
He was a rich man.
He was a rich member of the Sanhedrin. That's pretty significant, because in Jerusalem, which is the capital of Judaism, the Sanhedrin is the kind of the Jewish ruling council. So he's like Supreme Court justice, in a sense. He is going to be widely known and recognized. And he was also a wealthy member of the Jewish Sanhedrin. So he's on the level of authority in that era. If you want to think about it, he's very wealthy and he's very well known and has a lot of power and authority. And for it to be reported that it was his tomb, a couple of things could have occurred. They could have gone out and found Joseph and said, "Hey, Joe, someone's saying that they put Jesus in your tomb. What's up with that?" Okay, so he's a figure that when you put that detail in the account, it can be verified because he's such a prominent figure. Also, the fact that he was well, it probably would have been easy to identify. He was also wealthy, so he would have had a tomb that wasn't like the normal tombs. Okay, maybe a select few had those kind of tombs, but a lot of times, and we're going to talk about this, common people were just thrown into these open graves, or there would be these just wide fields, and they'd make shallow graves and just cover them with a small layer of dirt just to kind of get rid of them. They'd be outside of the town so that you wouldn't smell them. But not everybody had a tomb. That's the big thing. To be going around proclaiming, well, there's only so many, and it would have been easy for the opponents of Christianity to point that out. So he went to the wrong tomb doesn't really satisfy the problem, okay, because it just removes it one step. Okay, they went to the wrong tomb, well then what was to keep the opponents of Christianity from going to the right tomb and identifying the body and then closing the case. So the next one, he was really buried in a graveyard for executed criminals. And this is what I was just referring to in the idea that there were these graveyards for just kind of common person and for criminals. They would just lay their bodies out there, maybe put them in a very shallow grave. And the explanation continues in that some liberal scholars would explain his body not being there and that he was eaten by dogs. Have I talked about the Jesus seminar in here? My professor at Oregon State, one of my philosophy professors, was a member of the Jesus seminar, and his name was Marcus Ford. And the Jesus seminar, what they basically did is they came together in around the 1980s, mid-80s, and there was about 200 scholars that got together, and they started what was called the Third Quest for the Historical Jesus. And what they wanted to do is identify who was Jesus the man. Who was this guy? Okay, so they got these scholars from all over kind of to give themselves credit. Now, I think only 11 of them were New Testament theologian scholars. The rest of them were like botanists, medical doctors, I don't know. But they had a PhD. That was the key. To be in the club, you had to have a PhD. But it didn't matter what you had a PhD in. Okay. So what they did is they would get together and they would take the Bible plus the Gospel of Thomas. So there were five Gospels they would take. And they would go through and all of the red letter stuff, all the stuff that Jesus said, supposedly, they would evaluate and they would vote on it. And they would vote whether or not they think that's something that Jesus would have really said. And they had this voting system where they had a red bead or marble, and that meant that this is definitely something Jesus said. They had a pink bead, and this is represented, well, this is something like something he would have said, but not verbatim. This isn't exactly what he said. They had a gray bead that's basically represented this. He probably didn't say this, and everybody said he definitely didn't say this. And so they would get together, and after 6 months of study and research, they would take certain passages that they had decided upon beforehand, get together, and kind of share their research and their arguments, and then they would pass around a little velvet bag and then put the beads in it. And they would count the beads, and then they would conclude whether or not Jesus said it.
They have a lot of power, don't they?
Oh, yeah. And it's interesting because one of their base assumptions is we have to of this is though Jesus is not God. And by doing that, we have freed ourselves from a bias and we can approach it in a completely neutral setting.
There is no God, though. We're the smartest.
Well, and there's no neutral setting. You either believe he is or you believe he isn't. There's no neutral ground in that idea. And so as they approached it, some of the scriptural passages that would allude to his deity, they would say, well, he's not deity, so I don't think he would have. See that? 86% of what they found were black and gray beads are the words of Jesus. Some of the key phrases that we hang on to, they would have denied. And only 2% of what they found was red. Only 2%. And again, they were self-selective. They selected their own group. They've dwindled to now they have under 70 members in their club. But And Marcus Borg, my professor, is still one of those members. But they are the ones that promote this idea that he was really buried in a graveyard for executed criminals, and his body was eaten by dogs. What do you see about this?
Well, if that was the case, when it was written that it took so many men to roll the stone from the tomb, wouldn't they have corrected that statement?
Well, yeah, it would have avoided a lot of the statements, right? If he was buried in a graveyard for executed criminals and his body's eaten by dogs, we have a few problems because there were claims of who was present around the tomb, Roman centurions. It was in a tomb, there was a seal by Pontius Pilate placed on the tomb, there were linens found in the tomb. There's different things that are included in this account that would be needed if this was the case. So instead of trying to deny the empty tomb, they're denying just about everything else we know surrounding the event. And so that's one thing. The other thing is this idea that Roman guards, and this kind of goes back to it being the wrong tomb, because when they went to the tomb, there were Roman officials there. And the Roman guards that were guarding it came back and said, he's gone. And we even have an account in Matthew where the Jewish official said, here, we'll give you some money. Here's some silver. Save disciples, sold the body. Okay, we'll take care of the fact that, you know, you weren't able to apprehend them or something. We got you back. We're going to pay you to lie about what happened. And so we know that the Roman officials were there, and there was a controversy over the fact that the body was missing. And these Roman guards were going to have to account for it. Because if you know anything about Roman centurions, I did some research on this, that it took 25 years of faithful service in the Roman legion to become a centurion. You had to serve for 25 years faithfully. And so these are not soldiers that are just kind of new and they're the new recruits and they're out of boot camp or something. These are guys that are seasoned military, experts. And so the fact that they're there and they would have gone to the wrong tomb or guarded the wrong tomb is another slam against the original explanation we talked about. But also with this one, it doesn't seem likely that they would have guarded a grave of executed criminals. The second question is, well, how do you seal that? Okay? Because there's a couple of ideas as to how the tomb was sealed. There are some that say that around the tomb, they would have melted wax. Okay, they would have put wax around where the stone was laid in front of it. And that would have sealed it airtight. Okay, and that's one explanation for what it meant to be sealed. The other explanation is that they would have put a wax drip on it, and Pontius Pilate would have seen it ring, and he would have sealed it with his ring, showing that this is an official Roman site. This is sealed by Pontius Pilate. When you mess with this, you're probably going to die. That's an idea. So there's two ideas. So both of those kind of are hard to reconcile with this idea that he was laid in a graveyard for executed criminals, and his body was eaten by dogs. The third thing, this is kind of my own hang-up.
There's no written evidence that that's the fact.
Right, there's no account for that being the case or this. And so they would have the burden of proof to explain and to support their idea, whereas we have documentation. But the other thing is, the reason why they came to this conclusion is they said this is the most common thing that occurred in that time period. And it was common for men's bodies and women's bodies to be laid in these graveyards, and it was common for dogs to come along and rip apart their bodies and eat them. That was common. Well, if that's common, then what's the big deal? Why are we talking about it if that's what happened every day? If that's what's common, why were the apostles out there proclaiming that the body is missing and that he's risen from the dead, if that's what normally took place? It would be like me going out, jumping in a lake, and come running out and going, I got wet! This is crazy, I got wet in the lake! I mean, it's obvious, right? If that's the obvious thing that occurs, then it wouldn't be a big deal. But the fact that it was made a big deal, and it was so controversial, gives us reason to think that maybe it was something out of the norm. That what occurred was not something that was just run-of-the-mill and that happened all the time. Because if it was, not a big deal and people would have just dismissed it. So, the graveyard for executed criminals, and again, we have it being the tomb of Arimathea, and that specific detail is going to open itself up to inquiry, and if people find out that it wasn't Joseph of Arimathea's grave or tomb, then there's going to be people around that are going to question that and show it to be false. And so the fact that we've identified the grave as Joseph of Arimathea's and it was proclaimed not only within a couple of months, but it was a part of a Roman trial and Roman occurrences, and then we have reason to believe that this is definitely one. William Lane Craig points out that since we find no other burial story in denying the burial story, One is reduced to denying the historicity of one of the most straightforward and unadorned narratives about Jesus and giving credence to imaginary alternative stories that don't exist. Okay, so what they're doing is they're saying, this is the only account of how it took place, and so they're saying, reject this account and believe in our fairy tale-like accounts. Okay, we don't have a reason, we don't have any documentation for these other reasons, but we'd like you to reject what you do have documentation for to believe ours. All right, how are we doing so far? Good?
Yeah.
Okay. The next one is the disciples were hallucinating. Okay, this explanation emphasizes the emotional involvement of the disciples. The theory assumes that the disciples had the expectation that Jesus would resurrect. The interesting thing is hallucinating, this only addresses the appearances of over 500, the appearances of two individuals. This doesn't address the empty tomb. So as far as explaining why the tomb was empty, this one doesn't do it. But it's included because it is a popular idea. People like to say, well, all of the disciples and apostles and followers of Jesus were simply hallucinating when they saw him. Well, Gary Collins, he's a clinical psychologist, and he kind of focuses in the area of hallucination and kind of what is involved in the brain is doing that. And I usually share this quote within the PowerPoint, but the quote is that hallucinations require hopeful anticipation of a thing or an event. You have to have had the concept and the idea, but it also involves a hopeful anticipation of that. So even when people are on drug trips and they imagine themselves covered with spiders or whatever it is, there has been in their life a point in which they had anticipated or had that idea about themselves. And so this psychologist, Gary Collins, is not a Christian. He's just commenting on the fact that this is what is required in studies for a hallucination to occur. You have to have hopeful anticipation of a thing or an event. And so what this is assuming is that the disciples had the expectation that Jesus would resurrect, that they had that idea, that concept. And so evidenced by their behavior, we wouldn't identify that that was something they were expecting because they were doubtful and despairing. They left. They went back to their occupations. Also, in the several times that he tries to make them aware of what's going to occur, it says that they're completely ignorant, or their hearts are hardened. They don't understand. So this idea that they were expecting a resurrection to occur would be a little unfounded.
Yeah, because nobody at the crucifixion was like, "Oh, we're going to
do that." Don't worry, just wait it out. We got 3 days.
Yeah. There were no optimists.
Yeah,
no.
Exactly. And it ignores the fact of the empty tomb, which is the second thing. So it assumes the disciples had the expectation that Jesus would resurrect, and it ignores the fact of the empty tomb. Hallucinations involve prior beliefs existing in a person's subconscious. Just one way to put that. Hallucinations involve prior beliefs existing in a person's subconscious. So for you type A's, that's another point. Well, another thing is if they believed themselves to have a hallucination, they wouldn't have concluded that he in fact resurrected. Because a hallucination doesn't, if you're seeing a spirit, it doesn't require that their body physically be gone. You know? It would make more sense if the body was still there and they were seeing the spirit of Jesus or something like that. It would make more sense. And the other thing is hallucinations do not occur on a large scale. Hallucinations don't occur on a large scale. I think that it may have been Gary Collins, that psychologist, and I can get you guys the quotes, but he had concluded that in his research he had never found an account or a record of a mass hallucination occurring. That that's not something that's ever happened. Not even at, you know, Woodstock or something like that. it just doesn't happen. And think about it. A mass hallucination would require some medium projecting or suggesting a hallucination on everybody, the same image and that kind of stuff. But since hallucinations are these kind of subjective individual experiences that occur in a person's mind, it doesn't seem likely that without kind of some sort of projectings onto them that could happen. And so a group hallucination would be quite odd in the circumstance. And then the motivation over long term would require repetition. In order to keep this movement alive, you would have to repeat mass hallucinations, and the hallucinations would have to occur in different locations at different times as well. with unrelated people, this same vision would have to occur. Because there were people that had experiences of a risen Christ in different locations and places. So that one's a little hard to stomach, that there was that mass hallucination of over 500 people at one time seeing Jesus because of the appearance that was recorded in the 1 Corinthians. Okay, the fourth one. He never truly died. This is called the swoon theory. And this is in your Case for Christ, chapter 11, the swoon theory. And this one actually wasn't very popular. It was popular, I think, in like the 1920s. And then it kind of lost steam, and now it's coming back again. This is a popular idea. He kind of faked his death in a Romeo and Juliet kind of way. You know, he just took some sort of serum or something that made him appear dead. Or he just kind of toughed it out, and then he was able to resuscitate. Well, I mean, let's take into account. Let's take into account what would have to occur. If you've seen The Passion of the Christ, you can identify some of the brutality that's there. And there's that scene, I don't know if you guys remember this, but the camera pans down and shows the rocks on the floor. And it shows standing puddles of blood right there. And to imagine that he was the only one that had been lashed that day, so that was all from him. I mean, that severe amount of blood loss, what happens when someone just starts losing tons of blood?
Blood pressure drops. You go to shock and you die.
How much blood does it take?
How long?
How much blood?
If you lost half of your blood. Okay. Which would be like 2.5 liters.
And then what's it called when you go into... What kind of shock is it that you would...
Hypovolemic.
Okay. And that's kind of, you get dizzy, you get really weak,
yeah.
I would imagine.
I mean, you'd lose consciousness if your blood pressure was low enough. So
okay.
You have adequate blood flow.
Okay. So he's lost a severe amount of blood. And then we have witnesses, or kind of an account of him weak because he couldn't carry his own cross. Someone else had to carry it for him. And then he gets up there. Then they put nails, and they identify that they put the nails through his wrists instead of his hands. But there's some that say if they did put them through his hands, they would have tied his wrist up. But a lot of crucifixions occurred where they didn't want to have to take the time to tie things. They just nailed them through the wrist there and through the feet. And so when they did that, from my understanding, your shoulders would dislocate. They would stretch you out pretty far, and your shoulders would dislocate, so you would die quicker. Because what would have to happen is you have to push up to exhale. And so as his shoulders are dislocated and he's having to push up, finally you just get so weak that you can't push up anymore and then you die of asphyxiation. And so...
And if you didn't get that weak, they break your legs to make sure you couldn't push
right.
up.
Right. And we have it in the account is that they didn't break his legs. Not a bone of his was broken according to the prophecy. But they jabbed a spear in his side. Now, medical professionals in the room, what happens when you die of cardiac arrest? Is there like a... I mean, what happens if that occurs? Is there a sac that's around the heart? The pericardial sac filled with pericardial fluid? And is it a clear fluid?
It can be clear or bloody.
Okay. And so when the spear comes into his side and the appearance of blood and water comes in, would the water substance be probably pericardial fluid? Could it have been?
Bile.
Or it could have been fluid in his lungs.
Okay. And so, but that would probably... give us the evidence that he was probably dead. If blood and water or not. Okay. So he could have survived that.
If he'd been the soldier, that's the disease.
If they hit his heart or one or both, there's no way he would survive.
Okay. So, but what would they have punctured if bile came out? Like what's...
Gallbladder,
okay. And so if they hit a lung, there could have been lung fluid, heart, pericardial fluid, possibly. So this happens, and then they wrap him up in some cloth, and they put him in a tomb that took several men to close. And so, accordingly, what they're suggesting is that then he gets out of the folds it neatly in the tomb.
But he holds his breath this whole time that they're working on him, or somebody would have recognized
right,
him. Still
right, right. And then he moves the tomb, the rock, evades Roman guards, and then run miles and miles down the road to appear in the upper room. And here's the most... I mean, it's not the physical stuff that he would have to overcome. For me, it's the response of the disciple presence. Because if had he faked his death, had he actually faked it, I mean, he would have been... pussy and scabby and smelly, and they said his face was unrecognizable from the beating. He would appear, because he left his linen cloth behind, naked and pathetic looking. And he would have appeared in the upper room to the disciples, probably barely even standing, and said, "Here I am. I'm the Prince of Life, the King of Kings. I've conquered death." They wouldn't have been like, "Yeah, say hello to me." I mean, if you see someone who you care for, you've traveled with intimately for 3 years in that state, you wouldn't have been like, "Oh yeah, he has conquered." No, he evaded death, and he's lucky by the grace of God. They would have ushered him in, healed, you know, nursed him back to health, and then got him out of there. They would have, like, "Here, you need to go live in Egypt for a while, because if they find out you're not really dead, you're going to die. They won't refuse to be dead. They'll just cut off your head or something."
Yeah.
And so their response wouldn't have been praise, adoration, and devotion. They would have been let down. Here's the guy that's claiming to be the king of the world, the Messiah. This is how the Messiah is going to do it? He just got beaten within an inch of his life. And it doesn't seem that the response that occurred after 40 days they're out there proclaiming on the streets, then willing to suffer and die for their mission, that that would have been the case had they seen him in that condition. He evaded death. So, okay, let's see here. So he endured a brutal Roman flogging, which commonly resulted in hypovolemic shock. The result of losing large amounts of blood was evidenced by his staggering up the road and collapsing, as well as thirsting, placing him in a serious condition prior to the cross. Crucifixion results in two means of death, asphyxiation or cardiac arrest. Okay. And then what if he had survived and escaped? His condition wouldn't have inspired, like I said, others to preach about a resurrection or others to preach him as the Messiah.
Beautiful liar.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other thoughts on the swoon theory? It's one of those pretty far-fetched ones, but there are still people out there today. Okay, number 5, the grave robber stole the body. I guess the question, what would they have been after? What are grave robbers in it for?
They've been Jews. They've looked at the discredit.
Okay. So there could have been stolen, or religious motives, if it was the Jews, or even the Romans, if they wanted to do that. If it was the Jews, it would have been for the purpose of negating Christianity. And so when Christianity picked up steam because of this missing body, it would have been likely that they would have produced the body, or talked about the fact that they stole it and he really was dead, and they would have probably sought evidence to show that they had stolen it. I mean, they would have come clean, because that would then, they would see that their actions worked in the opposite of what they wanted to accomplish, so that they would have come clean to dissolve the community. If it was just regular grave robbers, though, because some people say it was just some hoodlums, some common criminals, what are they in it for?
Jewels.
Yes, I mean, because it was pretty common. I mean, it was not like an uncommon thing. People, when they saw a tomb, they would oftentimes be buried in the world with goods and goblets and jewels and what have you. And they would have goods with them to kind of commemorate them. But in this case, they break in, they evade Roman guards, and they see a guy with some linen cloth. So they take the linen cloth off. I mean, because even if they were going to steal the body, you'd think they'd want to, because if they were Jews, they wouldn't have wanted to touch the body. It would have been unclean. And so they would have probably kept the linen. But they left the linen behind. Take the body, it just doesn't make any sense. And to risk their lives with Roman guards, because not many tombs were guarded by Roman guards. So that would have been the deterrent factor. Maybe they would have thought, well, that one's guarded. It must have something valuable in it. They break in, maybe they're completely unaware of the events. They break in, they see just a body. I mean, they must have been disappointed if that's the case. So yes, again, they're after jewels, things of more value, not bodies. Unless it was what's that?
I mean, they suspected that the disciples would steal the body, so that's why they put the guards there.
Yeah, because Pontius Pilate didn't want any uprising, so they're like, let's make sure this stays under wraps. Just as a precaution, let's put some guards there. And then when the body is stolen, they say, well, let's blame it on the disciples. Well, I guess, and that's another theory that's a little bit further, so we'll talk about it then. Okay. The second one is a legend developed over time. It was a legend that developed over time. Well, the resurrection was being preached in Jerusalem within 7 weeks. And this is not enough time for a legend to develop in such detail. Anne Sherwin-White, who's a professor of history at Oxford University, he talks about that it takes two generations, more than two generations. Two generations is not enough time to pass by to kind of get rid of the actual facts and occurrences that took place. You have to have two generations pass before you can start to embellish a story, because there are too many witnesses to what occurred. It would be too unbelievable. And so here we have 7 weeks. Ian Sherman White says, professionally, as he reads history, it takes more than two generations. But here they're suggesting it happened in under 2 months. And this is not enough time. Second, does Mark 16, 1 through 8 sound like a legend? Okay, so let's open up to Mark 16.
Is there any evidence other than the Bible that it was 7 weeks?
The founding of the church. The physical church started within 2 months of the events taking place. And we have that evidence by the missionary journeys that took place. Eusebius is that historian I talked about, and there was a letter. Within a couple months, Thomas was dispatched to go and preach to that king, prince of Edessa, and healed those people and stuff like that. So we do have extra-biblical accounts of Christianity as an organization or as a movement starting within 2 months after the supposed resurrection. So that's, I think, probably the strongest evidence, the fact that we trace our lineage back to 2 weeks after the resurrection took place. So Mark, okay, pass that. Someone read that? Mark 16, 1 through 8. Anybody? Anybody? Okay, thanks, Paul.
When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. Very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. And they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back. It was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe, and they were alarmed. And he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid.
The inclusion of women provides evidence of accuracy for this account. Because they would not be included unless they were actually involved due to their low status and lack of authority as witnesses. And if you go back to the historical context of Jerusalem and Judaism, and just even the pagan world, women were not seen as equals. Women were property. They were possession that you could basically do with what you wanted with them. If a woman and a man were caught in adultery, the woman was stoned and killed. The man was told not to do it again. I mean, we have to understand how women were viewed in that culture. They weren't allowed to be witnesses in any kind of legal proceeding because their witness was not trustworthy. And so to identify the inclusion of women in the account of the Gospels shows us that if they were really trying to produce a legend that would gain popularity over time, that would have been a huge mistake because it wouldn't have been given credit because of the inclusion. And the women are the ones that supposedly found the empty tomb. Now remember, this is the crux of the faith. And we're going to give women credit. In that context, that was a huge mistake, because they weren't credible people. It would have been, who did you say found it? Oh, a woman? Okay. That explains everything. Yeah, I mean, that's how it would have been received. And so to identify this is huge. And this doesn't dissolve the power of the gospel. It gives it strength. It means that they weren't intending to develop a huge story that would have been fun to read. Because it wouldn't have been popular, because the readers would have been men. Right? They're the ones that would have tracked with it. Many women weren't given the opportunity to learn and get an education. It was Jewish boys that were. So it wouldn't have been a popular story because your heroes aren't necessarily men. And it's your heroes, Peter, are gone, denying. James, out of there. Okay? Your rocks of the faith are nowhere to be found, and it's women that are faithful. That's not our idea in Jewish culture in that time period. So there's that. And then William Lane Craig points out that it is unlikely the early believers would have made up the story of the disciples' hiding and cowardice, while women boldly observed the crucifixion, burial, and visited the tomb. A later legend would have had no difficulty making some of them, the disciples, discover the empty tomb. That they did not, but women do, makes it highly probable that women did indeed discover the empty tomb. And so even if it was something that developed over time, that this gives, I guess, strength to the accuracy also of the transmission of the Gospels to us. It would have been very easy for early church fathers to kind of amend some of this stuff. Maybe even take that section out if they weren't too confident in boldly changing it and making it Peter who discovered the empty tomb. Maybe they could have just kind of left that part out and just said the tomb was empty. Right? But they include a very detailed account of women going out, having a conversation, and discovering this. So the idea that it was a legend that develops over time, not only the amount of time it takes for a legend to develop is a little hairy here, but also who discovered the empty tomb shows us that it's certainly not a legend. Okay, then that other theory, the disciples stole the body, the conspiracy theory. What would they have to gain by starting a new religion, I guess? It's probably one of the main questions. If it was a conspiracy, conspiracies, remember, we lie for personal gain, sometimes to protect others, but conspiracy usually results in personal gain. So what would they have to gain from starting a new religion?
Wealth, fame,
power, authority. I mean, there's a list of things that people, all the time, we have cults starting, where their founders are in it for sometimes multiple wives, I guess. It occurs. Money. Maybe there's a pride thing involved here in that they want to feel important. So what do they gain? This seems odd because they gave up family. Number one, they gave up family and money to travel to foreign lands and preach. Number two, what they actually gained was poverty, persecution, and death. So much for money, power, and recognition.
Wait, we can't keep up there. That person's too long.
They gave up family and money to travel to foreign lands and preach the gospel.
Do what?
Two, what they actually gained was poverty, persecution, and death. Three, liars seek personal gain. But none of them exposed the lie to benefit themselves. I think this is pretty important. 11 of the 12 of them were martyred at different times and in different places. It would have been likely, given human nature and our selfishness, if this was a huge conspiracy and lie. When you're lying for personal gain, and then all of a sudden you're tortured, you're being humiliated, no one else that you made this pact with is around, it's likely that out of the 11 that were martyred, one of them would have cracked. It's just, that's human nature. One of them would have just given up and said, fine, we made it up.
Probably a lot more than one.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, more likely that maybe, it's unlikely that even one of them would have. But the fact that all 11 of them, at different times and in different places, they were being crucified upside down.
Jesus was even tortured to say it was not true.
Yeah. And so it just seems unlikely that as they're being tortured and persecuted and boiling oil is poured on them and they're thrown from a steeple of buildings, they survive. I don't know if you know the account of James, but he was captured. He was told to deny that Jesus was the Christ and that it was all a hoax. And they dipped him in a vat of bubbling, boiling oil and burned him. And then they took him up to the pinnacle of the church. They threw him from it and killed him and died. And so a big crowd came around and stoned him to death. It seems at some point you're going to give up if you're in it for personal pain, if you're lying, if it is a conspiracy. And then the fourth thing, they were willing to die for their message. They were willing to die. If it was a conspiracy, then it means it wasn't true. No one dies for a lie. They die for what they sincerely believe is true. So even martyrs in other faiths, Islam, different cults that come up, they're not dying for what they know is wrong. They don't know and they're convinced that it's false, their belief. They think it's true. And they die for what they sincerely believe is true. If this was a conspiracy, then we have 11 martyrs dying for what they know. That, again, the human condition doesn't seem possible.
Well, and what would have happened, say, a mob of apostles came in and stormed the centurions? What would have happened to them, you know, if they would have allowed somehow to overcome them? In Roman law, what would have happened to them?
They probably would have been killed. The Roman centurions that weren't able to protect their post, they probably would have fallen on their sword. They wouldn't have gone back to the and said, we got overpowered by some Jewish fishermen. They would have probably committed suicide. Just because in the Roman guard, it's such an honor thing. I mean, if you've seen Gladiator, it's like strength and honor. You know, and I think they would have been utterly humiliated had they been overcome. that way.
I think that, to me, that's the strongest evidence that that's not a true story.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, yeah, there are some fishermen going up, like professional, 25-year experienced military men that don't lose.
And they're a full army. I mean, it's just not two guys.
Yeah. So, yeah, it seems pretty unlikely. Okay. So people don't die for a lie. They die for what they sincerely believe is true. And so here we would have had probably one of the unique accounts of 11 guys that know there's a lie that they were a part of dying for something they knew was false. And so number 8, the resurrection. The fact that this explanation was being asserted provides us with only 3 options. Those spreading the idea were either 1, intentionally lying, 2, they were deceived, or 3, they were telling the truth. So they were either intentionally lying, as they proclaimed, as they were deceived, which the second one is probably the most believable, maybe. Maybe they just got so caught up in the movement that it was kind of this willful desire that it be true. You know, I mean, that's right, leads to hallucinations. Or 3, they were telling the truth. And reasons to reject options 1 and 2 have already been discussed here. We've looked at, you know, whether or not they were intentionally lying, and we've covered over the last several weeks whether they were deceived about what they believed. So 2 additional key points of evidence suggest that a resurrection is the best explanation for the empty tomb. 1, concurring eyewitness accounts. There you go, Mike. Just gotta wait for it. Just gotta wait for it. Concurring eyewitness accounts. So not only the appearance to the masses at one time, but also the appearances to individuals in different locations. I think that's important. And they're having very similar, visions. If they are appearances, they would be very similar. And then 2, the testimony of martyrdom, I think, is pretty huge. And we were just discussing what people are willing to die for. And there are that die sincerely in other faiths. You know, I think Islam is probably one of the biggest examples we have today of men and women so devoted to a cause, they're willing to give their life, and they're willing to strap arms to their children. That's a wholly different thing. And now that I'm a father, I could understand being completely devoted and being willing to sacrifice myself, but, I mean, the bond with my son, I can't imagine with that. I don't get it, but that's a whole other story. So the concurring eyewitness accounts, including, and then also the testimony of the martyrdom that occurred, not only from the apostles, but then the followers of Christ during all of the persecutions, I think give weight to this. Now, the key is what degree of explanatory power does the possibility have? And this is important. Does the explanation hold relation to facts other than the empty tomb? So all of these explanations, as far as, you know, explaining the empty tomb or hallucinations, they may address that one point, but do they have explanatory power beyond explaining that? Do they explain the transformation of the disciples? Do they explain a group of men being doubtful and despairing, all of a sudden these old proclaimers wanting to die for their message? That's a pretty big point. And do the other explanations have the explanatory power there? And then, do they have the power to explain the origin of Christianity, the transformation that occurred in believers, the martyrdom, the appearances? Do these other explanations have power beyond just the empty tomb or hallucinations? Do they have the power to explain to us what happened? To explain to us why we're sitting in this church today? Why for thousands of years people have devoted their lives to Christ? Do these other explanations explain that? And have that power? Okay, if an explanation fails to account for some of the facts, then its explanatory power is deficient relative to an explanation which accounts for all of the facts. Okay? If an explanation has explanatory power in some of the facts, it's deficient if there's an explanation that explains everything. The best explanation must explain more than just the empty tomb. And that's what we need to conclude here. And there are going to be other explanations that come up. People come up with other ideas, and there are going to be guys that are coming out with documentaries and archaeological finds that disprove Christianity. So I think we just need to really come back to, okay, what do we know? This idea of the best explanatory power is really more than evidence, because people want evidence. Give me evidence. And the question that Bill Jack from Worldview Academy always asks is, what would you accept as evidence? And I think that really gets to the heart of the issue, because sometimes they're giving you a smokescreen, they're giving you a response, give me evidence, and you ask, well, what would you accept? And that puts them going, well, okay, they probably won't accept any evidence, because it's not an evidential thing. Okay, it's a perspective, it's a worldview issue. It's a willful thing sometimes. And so we can put up these explanations, we can offer things, but unless the Spirit of God changes their heart and mind, it's not gonna have any ground. But we're told in 1 Peter, be prepared to make an offense and give an account for the hope that lies within you. And so that's what we're doing here today. And like I said, apologetics has purposes. One is to give a case, to present Christianity as true and valid to others, but it's also to give us confidence. And God has given us this stuff. And it strengthens our faith. It strengthens our witness to other people. So, any questions about this? Yeah.
I just have one question that didn't come up on Jesus' appearance after the resurrection, just on the fact that when he appeared to various people, he was not recognized, and then he brought his behavior in a different form. So it seems like if I were trying to point holes in the story, I'd be like, well, that was clearly someone pressing out with Jesus pretending to be resurrected.
Did you everyone hear her question? Okay. Like the road, was it the road to Emmaus? There's a sense of a I think there was it's a supernatural thing, in that a similar thing could be occurring when Jesus is performing miracles in front of his apostles, and they're not identifying his power as from God. And I just heard a great explanation of this moment, but I can't remember where I heard it. The fact that he was unrecognizable may say more about the people than him. I guess it may have been because they weren't expecting, and it may have been something that he, in a supernatural way, was disallowing them from understanding and recognizing right off the bat. But as far as him coming in different forms, I don't know that he was like a shapeshifter or something like that, which I don't think is being suggested. But are you guys finding the reference?
I've wondered about that too. But would it be, I think you sort of alluded to that, they were so surprised that it gives more credence. They didn't understand, and they wanted to be sure.
I mean, there's the road to Emmaus, and then there's when he's with the apostles. And he's invited in, and he's talking with them, and he's eating with them. And then they're like, holy moly. And I think it says more about them than it's him like not looking the same or whatever. I think there's this, it was not on their radar.
That's why I gave a comment. So everybody just adopted Jesus, but he wouldn't. He had to see those actual marks.
Yeah, and there's that explanation that Jesus had a twin brother. That's another one that's
that we didn't put that on the timeline. In the Luke account of the road to Emmaus, verse 16 says that they were kept from recognizing him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mark says he did appear in a different form. Afterward, Jesus appeared in a different form to two of them while they were walking in the country.
Right. Not that the Mark wording may mean that they were kept using a different form, so they were kept.
But also, then he appeared to Mary, and he's like, "What's wrong? Why are you crying?" Oh,
it gives us the understanding that there was intention behind it, that they were kept from, that there's a reason and a rationale. So, yeah, I mean, I can see how that sounds kind of fishy. I mean, why would he, did he look like a spirit, and then did he change? And there's kind of the illusion, or it alludes to the idea of hallucinations and stuff. Any thoughts on that? What do you guys think?
Well, I'm not sure. There's probably some out there that can give a really good, detailed, thoughtful explanation. For me, there's about the nature of God that I don't understand. And this may be one thing where I don't know why Jesus didn't allow certain people to recognize him, or didn't initially allow them to recognize him, and then later they did. Like Mary, at the tomb. First she didn't, she thought he was a gardener, and then all of a sudden she recognized him as her Lord. So
he's like heaven almighty. What's that?
In a sense, he wasn't human anymore.
But if you use that verse simply as your basis that this wasn't true, there's contrary evidence galore to overcome it.
And that's probably not your issue. Is that
to overcome what?
That fact. To say, well, yeah, but they didn't recognize him, but there are accounts where they did recognize him. So you really can't stand on that because you're trying to stand on something in the Bible. So you
can't
believe that it's true.
Can't stand on what?
That verse that says he was in a different form.
Oh. Right, and the account says that they were kept from recognizing. It's an identical account. It says they were kept from recognizing. So
which is a supernatural.
Right, you don't know what that different form was.
It says in Mark they refused to believe. And then the next verse says he appeared in a different form.
Maybe it was for his own protections.
It could have been.
Walking around the streets with
his
little hey,
yeah. There he is. It reminds me of Bruce Almighty. God played by Morgan Freeman. Like he's the ocean and then he's the janitor. I'm sure that's not how it was, but I think too there's something to be said about, and you were kind of alluding to this, Jeff, that we don't understand. There's a lot about God we don't understand, and I think there's a lot that we should be glad that we don't understand, because if we understood it all, then how impressive is God? If we could match his understanding and comprehension. God, I want him to be beyond what I can get, you know, and beyond what I can do. And so I think there's stuff like that, and we come into it and we're like, I don't understand this. There's a safety in that, you know what, God is bigger. God is smarter. That's good, because I'm an idiot, you know. And if me as an idiot can comprehend everything that I'm coming across in Scripture and it comprehend everything about God, then God's not all that great.
Well, what faith play in that? You have all the evidence and understand everything.
Yeah, if you had it all.
Well, and as far as actual writings, too, there must be some reason why they wrote that they didn't recognize him and then later did. Otherwise, they would have changed that account also. So there must be some kind of power behind it being written.
Mm-hmm. Supernatural. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, any other thoughts? I'm going to stop there. And next week, there's a reference page in here that has Messianic prophecy that we're not actually going to cover. That's there for your own, kind of, if you want to go and read through those, it's really fun. But I include that because I think the fulfillment of prophecy is a huge thing that supports who Christ is. And some of the spectacular matches that occur within Old Testament prophecy that are fulfilled later. And so I think that's a fun exercise to go through and identify these prophecies. And it kind of gives you what the prophecy is about on the left in the middle of the Old Testament and then the New Testament reference. So that's something to do kind of on your own time. I think it would be great. If you want to spend your quiet time over the next couple weeks reading through the prophecies and the fulfillment, it's really exciting and encouraging.
So a prophecy is just a hopeful anticipation, so that means an hallucination.
Right? A prophecy? Well, you have to ask the question, is did they hopefully anticipate these things would happen when they were thinking prophesying them? But then there's some that say prophecy fulfillment is just people writing it after the fact. There's some argue that they don't believe that the timeline of the Bible that we understand is the case that people went back and augmented some of the Old Testament books to match up with New Testament events to say, oh, look, a prophecy fulfilled when they actually, after the event took place, they went back. But the evidence that's stacked against those ideas is phenomenal. And the Jewish tradition is one of them. That the Jewish tradition that existed far before Christianity ever came on the scene and the stories that are involved there, I just don't think you'd get too far out the door in the Jewish synagogue trying to convince them that some of the stuff has been altered or changed after the fact. But it's good stuff. Check it out. And then we're going to be talking about faith and reason. And next week will be our last week. So come, enjoy, and it's been a good time. How many of you would like to go through another class that would be a continuation of, it would be Apologetics 2 and it would be in the fall? So it wouldn't be through the summer, it would be in the fall, once a week, probably another 3 months like this one was. Would you guys be interested in that? Okay, well, you guys can expect that then. We'll be doing that after school gets started. Thank you, guys.